You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new lecture series underway in Spring Green honors the life of a late UW-Madison dean. We'll talk with his spouse about the lectures and the conversations they're going to bring to the community. First, FBI Director Christopher Wray told a U.S. Senate committee today that, quote, there is no country that poses a more severe counterintelligence threat to this country right now than China. The FBI is asking research universities to come up with plans to keep a close watch on students and scholars from China. According to NPR, the agency has visited at least 10 members of the Association of American Universities, that's a group of 62 research universities, with a list of Chinese research institutions and companies. The agency says it keeps in regular contact with various groups, organizations, businesses, and academic institutions regarding national security issues. Universities are not required to comply with this request. Fred Kate is vice president of research at Indiana University. He specializes in information privacy and security law issues. Fred, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, your school, I understand, was a school contacted by the FBI. What do we know about what the FBI is looking for from universities?
Well, I think the FBI is looking for a lot, but I don't know that they're incredibly clear quite yet on what that is. So they're understandably worried about whether foreign influence is somehow either affecting U.S. research or taking away the benefits of U.S. research. The big focus, as you said, has been on China, and so they're both looking at types of research, but also looking at Chinese students, Chinese scholars, and visiting Chinese faculty who might be on campus.
And this happens pretty often. There are a lot of students and researchers who come from China and pair up with research institutions here or study here. This is pretty common, right?
It is very common. And it's, if you look across many, particularly STEM disciplines, but like computer science and things like that, across the country, we have a lot of Chinese students and we have a lot of Chinese faculty and Chinese visitors. It's a very important area, a very important area of collaboration.
What kind of areas does the FBI seem to be interested? As you mentioned, it is kind of vague, it appears, at this point, but it doesn't seem like they're focusing on particularly sensitive types of technological research.
Well, so far, we haven't gotten a sense of a real focus at all. And I should say Indiana University doesn't do classified research or research that would typically be subject to any secrecy provisions. The focus instead has been a lot of attention on the nationality of these people, and this is of course just a challenging issue. We, like almost all universities, but as a public university, we're open. Anyone's welcome here. You can come use our library. And it's very difficult to think of sort of trying to monitor students or monitor visitors to campus. That's quite different, of course, from if we had a particular sensitive facility, in which case we might restrict access by everybody who doesn't have a legitimate reason to be there.
Does an invitation from the FBI to in some way monitor some of these students and researchers from China conflict with what you see as your mission as a research institution?
Well, it poses a fundamental conflict because, and it's one of the things we often say when meeting, not just with people from the FBI, but with others who want to discuss this issue, and that is, we give away knowledge, we give away intellectual property. We have students come here in the hope that they will take it back to their home country or their home state and use the information there. And so the idea that somehow this is wrong or that this information is being purloined, it's hard to steal something that, folks will give you on the street. Again, it's a tricky issue. I'm not downplaying that there might not be some serious security issues, but typically when we think about security, we think about assets that need to be secured. Is there a particular thing, a particular lab? If we use a radiological substance in a lab, we obviously tightly control who has access to that, as opposed to thinking about the identity of, what people are on the campus.
Talking to Fred Kate, Vice President of Research at Indiana University, looking at a request from the FBI for many research universities to, in some way, monitor students and researchers from China. How much of this, Fred, could be an intellectual property concern? I know research sometimes at public universities, including the University of Wisconsin, ends up being patented. There are intellectual property rights. There are concerns with China as a government or companies within China stealing that kind of intellectual property. Is that possibly part of the concern here?
I suspect it is part of the concern. And again, we do worry about protecting intellectual property, but realistically, very few universities have a great deal of intellectual property that they protect. I mean, if you look across the university, it would be a tiny percentage of what we do that ever gets protected as a trade secret or protected with a patent. The vast majority of what we do, we publish. You know, we want everyone to know. We'd be thrilled if another person would read about it. And so particularly in areas like healthcare, one area that there's been a lot of talk in the press about the FBI's concern about whether some of this information is being exfiltrated to China. Again, we generally want students to come here, learn cutting-edge medical techniques, and then take them back to wherever they live.
So if I was a researcher, though, in an area that had some kind of classified link, if I was contracting on a Department of Defense thing that did, I don't know, cybersecurity, there would already be protocols in place for who can and can't access that information, right?
Absolutely. So for universities that do undertake classified research, the funding requires that you restrict access only to people who have clearances and only to people who are specifically authorized by the funder, usually the DOD, but it could be somebody else in the government, to work on that research. And in fact, even some research that's not classified, if we get DOD funding, DOD will reserve the right to approve who can work on that research. Again, we totally understand that. If you give money, you attach conditions to it, we can either live with the conditions or not take the money. It's the kind of broader after the fact, watch everyone that we don't quite know what to do with.
Now, speaking of funding, another concern that the FBI has raised, I understand, with universities is taking funding from Chinese firms, notably Huawei. Back in May, the Commerce Department put Huawei on a trade blacklist. Why the focus on this particular company?
Well, again, I think the fear there, and I mean, there's been new evidence released even this week, is that Huawei is, in some cases, violated the sanctions regime by providing support to North Korea, and in other cases may have been used by the Chinese government to exfiltrate data from Huawei networks, not in China, but elsewhere. But even here, I think, we feel a little bit whipsawed because, of course, the president came back from his last summit and said, he was temporarily waiving the restrictions on Huawei. And so it's very hard when you're told one day to do one thing and then the next day the president says do something else to be clear on what is the responsible thing to do.
As a research university, when you look at taking money from, I guess, any company, do you consider what use it might be put to by that company, or in the case of something like Huawei, if that will be filtered through to the Chinese government and used for negative purposes?
We do consider that. I mean, we consider a lot of things. We, for example, we don't generally allow, we don't accept funding that involves restraint on publication. We want to know if we do the research that we can actually make it available. And so we'll accept, very short temporary limits, for example, to go out and file a patent. But we won't accept lasting limits. That research can be done elsewhere, but not at least at this university. And similarly, we always consider the source of the funding, what the research will be used for. I mean, again, as a public institution, we certainly have public obligations. Having said that, though, we also believe pretty strongly in academic freedom, which is that a researcher gets to make, rational choices about what he or she wants to research, provided that there's funding available to do it. And so we try to balance these competing interests all the time.
Now, this don't take money from Huawei appears to be just guidance, a request at this point. Could the federal government or some agency within it say Huawei's off the table, they can't fund research at public institutions anymore?
I think now it's moved beyond a request. I mean, the Department of Commerce maintains a list of entities that U.S. institutions are not permitted to do business with, and it's now listed on that. It's now included on that list of entities.
So, looking to the future now, what are you watching for next? More detail from the FBI on their request for monitoring of Chinese researchers. What are some of the next steps here?
So I think there are a lot of things. One is we are in active dialogue with the FBI, and we appreciate the chance to do so, to try to help focus so that we can spend our energy and scarce dollars on the things that would be most likely to actually protect against something that could threaten national security. And if that means identifying types of research that might be particularly sensitive or particularly targeted, we don't want anyone stealing that type of research, or particularly taking it until it's ready to be made made public. We've also suggested a broader dialogue in general between the national security community and the FBI and universities to try to, you know, set some rules of the road. So again, we know, you know, it's very clear if a law enforcement officer shows up and they have a warrant, we comply with it. That's what the law requires. But it's very hard when somebody shows up and sort of has some advice. And so we're trying to get to clearer procedures so that we know what we're doing and we know when we need to act and when we can just take advice as advice and do something different.
Fred, thanks a lot for joining us today.
A real pleasure and good luck.
That's Fred Cate, Vice President of Research at Indiana University. He specializes in information privacy and security law issues. We talked to him about the FBI's call for American universities to come up with protocols for monitoring certain Chinese students and researchers. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new lecture series starting this week will dig into ideas like aging and happiness and how to be a better listener in a world that seems divided. The series honors a legacy of Joshua Morrill, a University of Wisconsin-Madison assistant dean who passed away unexpectedly in February. The first talk of the Morrill Lecture Series is this Thursday evening at the Octagon Barn in Spring Green. Steph Morrill is the founder of the Morrill Lecture Series in Spring Green. She's in the studio with me now. Steph, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, can you tell us about the origins of this lecture series?
You bet. So Joshua and I grew up in Jamestown, New York, which is very close to Chautauqua Institution. And Chautauqua Institution is this beautiful place where every summer people get together and think about ideas in this gorgeous setting. And when we moved to Spring Green in 2013, we felt like it was the perfect place to do something similar. And when our friends right down the street from us refinished the Octagon Barn, we realized that was the location we wanted to do it. So we were working on the lecture series and starting to find funding for that. And that's when he passed away in February. So I decided to continue that on and made that one of the ways that people could donate was to begin this lecture series in our community.
I'm sorry for the loss of your husband earlier this year. As you and he were putting this together, what kind of set a scene for us? Like, what would the experience be like as you envisioned it?
We really wanted it to be a place where everybody would be welcome to come in and to think about big ideas and to do that in a conversational and really comfortable way. And when I think about it from sort of thinking about Joshua's legacy, I think there's three things that I've been thinking about a lot. One is just trying to stay hopeful, right? That we want this to be a place where people can be inspired in this time when maybe there's not all that much inspiration around, that we can change things and we can learn from one another. So that's one thing. The second thing was this notion of action, right? That it's great to be thinking in an inspired way, but without trying to change things, nothing is going to change. And I guess the last thing was this notion of respect, right? These issues that we're facing in our world are complex, but we need to be able to get together and talk and think about these regardless of whether or not we completely agree. And so trying to set an environment where people with different viewpoints can hear and talk to one another, that was really important to him.
And you were, as you said, new to Spring Green 6 years ago,
yes.
It sounds like.
Yes.
Was part of this hey, we're in a new place and we want to be part of this.
Yes. And I think Spring Green is a beautiful community for it because we have so much arts and culture and people coming into the community for arts and culture. And so we thought it would be the perfect place to get people thinking and talking about these bigger issues.
Talking to Steph Morrill, founder of the Morrill Lecture Series in Spring Green. And Steph, the big debut.
Yes.
2 days from now? Do I
yes.
have that right?
Thursday, July 25th.
Yeah, talk about the first lecture. You've got a few set up for this season.
We do. We have three set up for this season. All the lectures are at 7 o'clock, and there's a potluck, community potluck, to give people a chance to talk to one another before that. But John Leland, I'm so excited about this. John is a New York Times reporter, and he wrote a book called Happiness is a Choice You Make. It's a best-selling book. He did a series where he actually spent time over a course of a year with six people who were in the category, I've never had heard of this category before, but demographic category of oldest of the old, right? Mm-hmm. These people were 85 years or older, and he sort of expected to hear about the pain and misery of being 85 and older and found that that was not the case at all. And so he wrote a book about the lessons that he learned from them about happiness and about living a really good life. And so he'll be kicking off the series on Thursday.
Well, I can't really plug things, but I will say he has been on the show with us before to talk about the book. Definitely a great talker. He'll have a lot to say. So that sounds really exciting. And did a theme kind of emerge in this first series of three lectures?
You know, it's so interesting. I hadn't intended it to, but it definitely did. And I think it's a great reflection of Joshua. And Joshua, it was really important to him that people were heard, regardless of where they were coming from. And he spent a lot of time listening and encouraging that. And so this theme of like listening to others and what we can learn from that has really emerged through the course of this series for this season. So can I talk about the other two?
Please do, yeah.
Okay. So August 29th, we're going to have Pardeep Kalika. And he was, his father was one of the people murdered at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek in 2012. And he has had an amazing experience where he has partnered with a former skinhead and a founder of a large racist organization who has had felt some guilt about that incident, and they've worked together now to create both an organization and write a book called The Gift of Our Wounds, and he's going to be talking about that.
And he's got an amazing story. I was lucky enough to see him speak in Milwaukee a few months ago, and that again, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, just a powerful
story. Super excited. Yeah. I think he's going to be an amazing speaker and a great thing to bring to our community. And then the last one is Dr. Kathy Kramer, who wrote The Politics of Resentment, and she's going to be talking about some of her work she's been doing with MIT around trying to create ways for people to hear other people's opinions and be more responsive to that. So her talk is called Listening Well in a World That Turns Away. And I'm really excited to have her talk about that too. Yeah.
And I should vouch for her too.
Yeah.
Not that you need me to vouch for all your speakers.
This is wonderful.
The show. Yeah.
I appreciate it.
So they're going to be speaking, but part of it sounds like you want people to participate too.
Yes. I'm hoping that we'll be able to have conversations both during that time, but also within our community. So I'm hoping people will come and be inspired and continue the conversations in whatever groups or in their family or however they can. So I'm really looking forward to the opportunity for people to interact with these speakers, but then also continue that conversation.
Talk about the setting now. You mentioned
yes.
The Octagon Barn.
Yes. The Octagon Barn is an 1890s barn that was recently refinished in a very historically, I would say, historically respectful way, right? It's not super polished. It has its age. It's a beautiful, beautiful location. And they use it for weddings and for other events. And they're friends and neighbors of ours. So we're really, really excited to be hosting the series for us.
And there's something about that. It's not a stuffy lecture hall
No.
or a fancy, you know, thing across the street at the business school here. It's like rustic, rough-hewn, it sounds like.
Yes, and it's a beautiful location in the middle of Prairie. So it's one of those things where I'm hoping people will be inspired both by the speakers, but the location and just that feeling of community we're trying to build.
Yeah, talk about what you're hoping to inspire after the lectures are done.
Yeah, I'm hoping this will be an ongoing series we'll do every year. I hope that what this will inspire is sort of continuing these conversations throughout the year. I'm hoping it will inspire people to, frankly, recognize Spring Green as an awesome place to visit and come spend some time, because Joshua was a huge Spring Green advocate. You didn't get out of a conversation with him without talking about how awesome Spring Green was. So I'm hoping it'll open some minds and doors for that. And just again, like trying to continue that spirit of hope and community that I'm trying to build this year throughout the coming years.
It seems like part of an amazing American tradition going back to Native American
yeah.
gatherings and early days. You think of a town hall meeting,
yes.
and it seems like we've lost that in a lot of ways.
We have. And I my other hat, I work with libraries. So that notion of community building and bringing people together to have conversations is sort of in my DNA. So I'm really excited to reflect that back out with this series.
If there's somebody out there listening in another maybe smaller town around the state and they'd like to steal your idea
yeah.
in a good way, what would you recommend? How would they get started doing that?
I think one of the things that I'm going to add next year is sort of a committee of people. I did this one all on my own because of time and just like I need to get it done. But I would encourage people to bring together a few people who are interested in doing this in community, bounce ideas around, and then just go ask. Like John Leland, I didn't know him. I just wrote him an email and he got right back to me in a day and was like, yes, I'm thrilled to come and do this. So I think that you just have to think big and do it. Yeah.
What kind of community response have you gotten leading up to the big debut on Thursday?
People are excited. And I think we have Joshua and I have the great fortune of having multiple communities. There's the UW community that he worked with as an associate dean in the graduate school. I'm sorry, an assistant dean in the graduate school. And I have my library community, and then we have the Spring Green community. And I think all of them are really excited to be part of this and see sort of his spirit reflected back into something bigger.
Does that give you, I don't know, a sense of optimism?
Oh, totally, yeah. Yeah, I think it's, you know, grief is a hard thing, and how you react to grief is a hard thing. But I think knowing who he was and what he was trying to do and trying to always make things better made me want to do as much as I can to carry on that spirit.
I want to talk about the logistics some a little bit here. If people are interested in going,
yes.
How can they find out more? Do you need to RSVP? What do people need to know if they want to go?
It's an absolutely free opportunity. Donations will be gratefully accepted, but please just come. You can learn more by going to morallectures.org. That's three L's. So M-O-R-R-I-L-L lectures.org.
Okay. And do you have RSVP so far? Do you know if you're going to have a packed house?
I have no idea. We'll see what happens on Thursday.
Okay. Yeah. And are you, I don't want to put you on the spot already, but do you have names in mind, potential speakers in mind for next year?
I have a couple, but I am accepting any ideas people have. So if they come and want to offer suggestions or just want to offer suggestions, I would be grateful to hear them.
All right. Well, good luck with the big opening stuff. Thanks a lot
Thank
for coming
you.
Into the studio.
I really appreciate the opportunity.
Been talking to Steph Morrill, founder of the Morrill Lecture Series in Spring Green. She joined us today to talk about the lecture series and the legacy of her husband, Josh Morrill. The first talk of the Morrill Lecture Series is this Thursday evening at the Octagon Barn in Spring Green. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's been 10 years or so since the Great Recession officially came to an end, but the recovery from the historic economic downturn took well over a decade. Many people still feel the impact today. Wisconsin's economy has mostly recovered and has been pretty healthy, seemingly, for the last few years. Unemployment has been at or below 3%, and last year the state saw its best year for growth since 2010. Well, that's good news. The state's economy could still slow down in the coming years. Our next guest is a reporter who took a look at state data. In a bit, we'll also talk to an economist about what all of this could mean for the state in the future, and we'll invite your calls as well. Arthur Thomas is a reporter for the Biz Times Milwaukee. Arthur, thanks a lot for joining us on Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you dug deep into statistics, Arthur, talked to some experts also. What were some of the big things you were looking for, trying to tease out here?
Well, you know, this story was part of our annual mid-year economic trends issue that we do. And we kind of had the question, you know, how is Wisconsin stacking up to the rest of the country when it comes to economic performance? In a lot of cases, you know, state economies kind of follow the national trend, and you know, the national economy has been doing well. So the question was really, you know, how well is Wisconsin stacking up? And you mentioned a couple of the kind of the headline numbers, the you know, unemployment rate being at or below 3% for a number of the last months, best year of GDP growth since 2010. So those, you know, really seemed like good, you know, headline numbers. But you kind of look a little bit deeper. Wage growth, you know, in the first half of last year was decently strong, and then kind of just fell off a cliff in the second half of last year and the first 5 months or so of this year. There's been a little bit of uptick the last 2 months, but kind of a long trend of for the last year or so of wages not growing as strongly as maybe the rest of the country. And then the other one was in labor force participation, which peaked most recently in mid-2017. And it's been kind of trending downward for the last 2 years now with fewer people in the workforce.
Now, when we compare Wisconsin's unemployment rate and the changes there and the product, the GDP of Wisconsin, with those national trends, as you were mentioning, how does Wisconsin look compared to the country as a whole?
Well, I mean, in terms of unemployment, you know, 3%, you know, is below the national rate of 3.7 or so that's at. So that's certainly good. And as far as GDP, you know, last year we ranked 17th in the country. So that's, you know, top half. That's not terrible, not great, but not terrible. And it was the narrowest gap we've seen in since 2010 or so between the national GDP rate of 2.9 and the state's 2.5. So a narrowing there, and certainly good to have a lower unemployment rate than the national. So stacks up okay. I guess would be the best way to put it.
And generally, when you look at trends over the years, don't we usually have a little bit lower unemployment than the nation as a whole?
Yeah, I think that would be the case. And also the GDP has been lagging behind as well, maybe seeing stronger growth other parts of the country.
You mentioned labor force participation. That's how many people are actively in the job market, either with jobs or seeking jobs. Wisconsin, it looks like, may have some special cases. We hear it's tough to hire people in Wisconsin. We hear about our aging population staying in the workforce. What kind of things do you see there?
Sure. So, I mean, I cover manufacturing at this time. So, you know, I hear from a lot of manufacturers all the time about how they, you know, are having a hard time finding people. They can't get, you know, qualified workers they need, things like that. You know, it's pretty much when I ask people what their challenge is, I almost ask it, you know, other than talent, what's your biggest challenge? So, you know, looking at the workforce participation, you know, we've seen fewer people in the workforce in the last 2 years or so. If you do the math, it works out to about 24,000 fewer people. So that's kind of contributing to that unemployment rate staying low and, you know, probably also contributing to people not being able to find the workers they're looking for. You mentioned the aging workforce, which would seem to kind of explain it, you know, why we're seeing fewer people in. One of the economists I talked to said basically, you know, nationally we're seeing workers stay in the workforce longer, people kind of postponing retirement, staying involved, continuing to work. So his point was basically, unless Wisconsin's bucking the national trend, that probably doesn't explain what's going on here.
And Arthur, when it comes to wages, the puzzle with the Great Recession was all through the recovery, unemployment was going down over time, wages not going up, though. And so with this tight labor market in Wisconsin, with the recovery in place, what are people's thoughts on why wages haven't come up to as much as they might be expected to match that?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a couple, you know, potential explanations. One theory is you have maybe, again, bringing up older workers, but maybe you have older workers retiring out. They've been at a higher wage, being replaced by someone younger. And so maybe, you know, the math works out that the wage growth doesn't, you know, really happen when you're working with averages. Another one, maybe in terms of the mix of jobs, if you're, you know, manufacturing jobs haven't been growing super strong. We've seen a lot of growth in like leisure and hospitality, for example. So if you have a lot of restaurant jobs at a lower wage, that can mess with, you know, the average number, even if, you know, some groups are seeing some wage growth and some aren't. So there's probably some different kind of, you know, pieces that are pluses and minuses to the wage puzzle. But it is interesting that you just haven't seen, you know, sustained robust wage growth for quite some time.
Arthur, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Arthur Thomas, reporter for the Biz Times Milwaukee. He joins today to talk about his recent piece, breaking down a potential slowdown in wage growth and labor participation in Wisconsin, and just putting a finger on the pulse on the state of the economy in the state this year. Now we turn to our next guest for a broad look at the state of the economy in Wisconsin and how the Great Recession might still impact us today. You can join in with your thoughts on the Great Recession, the recovery, if you feel the state has fully recovered since the downturn, and tell us how it's all affected you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Abdur Chaudhry is a professor emeritus in the Department of Economics at Marquette University. Abdur, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Big picture, Abdur, how did Wisconsin weather the Great Recession and recovery?
Wisconsin was not affected as much as some of the other states in the union during the Great Recession. For example, if you compare Wisconsin with California or Texas or Florida, we didn't suffer as much. So our recovery also has been slightly slow, but we have done reasonably well in the last 10 years.
And does that mean that the Great Recession didn't maybe have as long-term an impact on people's finances? I know a lot of other states looking back had bigger problems when it came to foreclosures and things like that, really wiping out people's wealth. Did it not hit us as hard in that way in Wisconsin?
Yes, especially the housing market was not hit as hard here as in other parts of the country. So the Great Recession did affect us, but not to the same degree as in some other states.
Now, we just heard from our reporter guest, Arthur Thomas, there about the puzzle of wages in Wisconsin not recovering along with this tight labor market. What are you looking at in that story?
Wages, this is sort of a national trend. We have seen that nationally also wages have remained relatively stagnant, has moved sideways but not increased that much. We see the same story here in Wisconsin. Wages have remained relatively stagnant. There are a couple of reasons for that. One, obviously, is what we have seen in the last couple of years is that a lot of jobs have been created in the service sector. Not that many jobs have been created in the manufacturing sector, which are high-paying jobs. So what we see is we have created a lot of low-paying jobs, which don't pay as much. So overall, wages have not increased that much.
I know a lot of people look at Wisconsin and think we're an agricultural state, which we are, but we're also a pretty big manufacturing state, right? It's a pretty big part of our economy, isn't it?
Yes. In fact, about almost 20% of our GDP comes from manufacturing compared to, let's say, about 12% nationally. So we depend on manufacturing more than most of the other states in the country.
What kind of things are we hearing in the manufacturing sector about the future? I've heard concerns about uncertainty for a variety of reasons. What are you seeing?
Yes, uncertainty is the big thing in the manufacturing sector. That's why we see manufacturers are hesitant in investing in the near future. The main reason for that uncertainty is the trade dispute, the tariffs, trade dispute with China. That is affecting manufacturing in the U.S. because U.S. manufacturing depends a lot on trade, you know, the import, the export. So what happens in the external sector does have an impact. So as a result, we do see a lot of manufacturers are sort of taking a wait-and-see policy. You know, they want to see what will happen before they decide to invest significantly in the sector.
I know with agriculture and manufacturing in Wisconsin, we do a fair amount of exporting. Have we seen declines at all in exports to other countries from Wisconsin?
In the last couple of months, we have seen some changes in both export and import. That's mainly because of the tariff. So it has affected Wisconsin, the dairy products, and in some of the motorcycles, for example. So we did see some impact.
Talking to Abdur Chaudhry right now about the state of Wisconsin's economy 10 years after the official end of the Great Recession. He's professor emeritus in the Department of Economics at Marquette University. We'll bring on a caller now. Stan is with us in West Allis. Stan, hi.
Yeah, hi. Good evening. Thank you. I'll just comment and no question. This gentleman, rightly so, he knows what he's speaking about. We're talking about the tariffs having an effect on manufacturing. I'm the baby boom generation. We as baby boomers were heavily involved with manufacturing throughout the state. And as we've aged and left the workforce, there hasn't been, and there probably will never be, a base of people to make up that difference. So therefore, they go into not manufacturing anymore, but into banking, into accounting, into things that aren't maybe make-type industries, but more service oriented. So that's all I'm saying is, you know, we talk about manufacturing being a problem. It wasn't, but now it is because of what I say. You don't have the people involved.
Thanks. Interesting. Stan, thanks a lot for the call. Abdur, is that something we see? We're having people age out of skilled manufacturing jobs and not having a younger generation picking that line of work.
Yes, that's true. And one thing that we have noticed in Wisconsin the last couple of years is out-migration of younger population. When students graduate from school or university, most of them tend to leave the state and go to, say, bigger cities. So out-migration of younger population is a big problem in Wisconsin.
And we hear also, thanks for that call, Stan, we hear in the agricultural sector, aging farmers not necessarily having a younger generation to take on, especially maybe those smaller farms. Is that part of the same story, Abdur?
That's part of the same story. You know, the younger generation, they don't want to stay in farming. They want to do something different. As a result, we see a lot of farms being sold on a daily basis in Wisconsin because they don't have the workforce or they simply cannot meet their cost.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Jane is with us in Milwaukee. Jane, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that I was laid off 10 years ago in Milwaukee. I was in publishing. It took me a year, but I was fortunate to find another job. However, I'm still not making the salary that I was making 10 years ago, and I'm wondering if that is a common occurrence.
Well, before I throw that to Abdur, I mean, how is that, if I may ask, Jane, how has that affected your finances, your planning for the future?
Well, I should also mention that I had a lot of retirement savings in a 401k and lost quite a bit of that when the market plummeted. And then that money, because I was then laid off, I didn't have a whole lot to transfer over into a new type of savings account or retirement account. So I'm definitely behind in my retirement savings and probably will work longer than I had expected I would 10 years ago.
Jane, thanks a lot. Sorry for what happened. Good luck to you in the future. Abdur, is this a common story that a lot of people, even if they ended up with a new job, there's this big setback that even years after the Great Recession might affect their, as in Jane's case, retirement planning?
Yes, that's a problem in Wisconsin we have seen. We call it a skills gap. You know, employers are looking for people with a certain skill, but the people who are available in the job market, they don't have that particular skill. As a result, those who are getting jobs, they don't get the pay that they deserve or the pay that they used to get in their previous job. So that is also one reason why wages have remained relatively stagnant.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Abdur Chaudhry, Emeritus Professor of Economics at Marquette University, looking at the state of Wisconsin's economy 10 years after the official end of the Great Recession. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Lac du Flambeau. Karen, that's not Karen. Let's try Dave in Eau Claire. Dave, hi.
Yeah, this is Dave. So I work for a large U.S. manufacturer, and I've been in manufacturing, called on manufacturing for the last 30 years. And there's been two massive investments. The one massive investment is stock buybacks have been massive the last two or three years. And automation has increased productivity about, I'd say, 1,000 to 1 in the last 15 years. So you can't say that manufacturing is decreasing. We have that big of an automation gap.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. He brings up two really interesting points, Abdur. Let's tackle that second one. Automation, we are producing a lot of stuff, but without having to add workers in many cases to do it.
Yes, he's correct, actually. If you look at the proportion of the economy that goes into manufacturing, that hasn't changed much. It's 12% at the national level, 19% to 20% in Wisconsin. But what has happened because of automation, less people are now working in the manufacturing sector.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Dave also mentioned Abdur stock buybacks. And now in the argument over the impact of the big Republican tax cuts under the Trump administration, some people have pointed toward job creation. Some people said, hold on, a lot of this money seems to be going into stock buybacks, which doesn't necessarily affect our employment outlook. What are you looking at as you try to figure out what happened there?
That's what happened. In fact, that's one of the things that many people thought will happen because of that tax reform. When corporations were allowed to bring back money over that they kept overseas. So what happened, many corporations, what they did was instead of reinvesting that money in the U.S., they used that for buying back stocks. So we have seen that happen in the last 2-3 years.
Thanks a lot for that call. Looking to the future, not trying to predict the future, though, Abdur, what kind of signs are you watching for the future of the national and state economies?
Okay, this is something that people ask me all the time. Will there be a recession soon? I don't think we are going to see a recession in the next, say, 9 months to 12 months. So in the next 1 year, I don't see any recession happening. I do see both the Wisconsin and the national economy sort of slowing down a little bit compared to, let's say, what we had seen in 2018. in 2019, I expect the U.S. economy will grow around somewhere between 2% to 2.5%. So it's slower, but not in the nothing to be very much concerned about. And the U.S. will be doing much better than many of our trading partners in Japan, in Western Europe. U.S. will be doing much better. But there are some uncertainties that I see in the future. One, obviously, is tariff, the trade dispute. The other is the Brexit in Europe, you know, when Britain leaves the European Union in October. What happens and how does that affect the U.S.? That will be another uncertainty that we are going to face. So manufacturing will face some uncertain future in the next 12 months, but I don't see things to be too bad.
And Abdur, in just our last few moments, we just had an election for governor last year. There's a lot of argument about the impact of state policies on the state economy. I've probably asked you this before. How much control does a state-level government have over its own economic well-being?
To be honest, not much. because the state economy, to a large extent, is affected by what happens nationally. What the state government can do is, in areas where there are some problems, they can step in to fill up the gap, to try to relieve some of the problems. So the state government can play a role in, you know, resolving some of the problems that arise because of what is happening nationally. But in terms of affecting the state economy, I think the state government doesn't have that much of a role.
Abdur, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
That's Abdur Chaudhry, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Economics at Marquette University. He joined us today to talk about the decade following the Great Recession and the state's economy since then, and a quick look at the future as well.